tell Don not to give it to her?
Don Grady would answer that. So that you know, Commissioner Fox, I do not micromanage that agency, but I do a lot of communicating. I'm a communicator. I stood and talked with Tim Brannigan last night, the steward, for a long time. I talk with different bargaining unit people. I talk with administrative people. I asked Don Grady specifically, why did Candace Brooks from the Journal ask for information and you not get it to her when she asked for it? And she explained to me why. I don't know that I would have made the same judgment that Don did, but would you let Don at least answer why it took 4 weeks? Yes, Don, would you please come and answer that?
Sir, the original request was made verbally, and the request asked for a specific spreadsheet, I guess the one that you have there, and by title. We don't have that spreadsheet inside of our organization. I looked for it. We couldn't find it. And so, therefore, on August 8th, the request came to me by email. And, of course, you know, on August 15th, Marcus went missing. So each time the request was made, I asked the reporter exactly, you know, what information she's looking for. And she also asked for comments. So what comments do you want me to specifically make? She repeatedly told me on three times and as late as Friday of last week that she wasn't planning on doing a story. So that lets me know that the information then is just information. There's no sense of urgency to get that together for her. So I've never denied her the opportunity to get this information. It's just simply a matter of time. She asked for a specific document that did not exist. When she asked for the information that she wanted, time went away. She's gone on vacation before. She's gone to, I believe, the NABJ conference and other things. So things have happened. It's never been denied to her at all. But it was always told to me that there was no story, which lets me know that it's probably something that maybe you were looking for. Maybe if you had that sense of urgency, maybe you could have requested it.
Well, were you confused about what she was asking?
Certainly, because she asked me for a spreadsheet by title that did not exist.
Did you know she was asking about the Talbert House contract?
Yes, but she asked me for a specific spreadsheet by title that did not exist.
Okay. Did you know that she was asking about utilization numbers versus expenditures?
Yes, I did.
So you understood she may not have been familiar enough with the jargon of the agency to ask the right question. In other words, in your files, there's a document under a title.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So you wanted to make it a scavenger hunt. I'll give you that document if you're smart enough to ask the right question that includes that title. Is that?
No, if I'm asked for a specific document by title, then I'm looking for that particular document by title. When the request came in formally on August 8th was the actual date of the formal request. Then she actually mapped out information, but she also said she wanted us to provide some comments. We were digging up those comments because we had other implications. I have Talbert House to think about in this too. And one thing we don't want to do is put ourselves in litigation by putting something out there that we haven't dotted all I's and crossed all T's. The information was never denied to Candace, but number one, it was repeatedly stated and as late as Friday, September 1st, that there was no story. So,
okay, well, whether it's a story or not is not the standard of whether or not you give information. And this goes to
I would agree with that.
The question that this exemplifies the problem that when I talk to parents that they have. I've talked to Bill about several, you know, I thought the issue of can a parent have their psychological examined? I thought we took care of that 5 or 6 years ago. Well, apparently there are people in the organization don't know that's been resolved. I thought that we took care of the issue. If I want to sign a release of documents and release it to the world, that was taken care of. But yet on this 11-year-old boy, because I did this as a customer service test, I told the mother yesterday, tell the caseworker when she comes that you want to sign a release, because there's only her, to my knowledge, there's only her and the child that she has legal custody over, and said, tell the caseworker that you want to sign a waiver of release of all documents. and ask the caseworker if you can have that released to the press or to yourself or whoever you want. Caseworker didn't know the answer to the question. Well, the answer from what the policy is in your board is the answer is yes. Why would a caseworker not know that? That's the type of stuff. Why would it matter whether it was a story, not a story? You understood
she
what
asked
she was
for other
asking.
Information that I was still gathering. What I'm suggesting here is that there was the sense of urgency that you are relaying right now seems to be your sense of urgency. I didn't get that sense of urgency from the reporter. So maybe this is a discussion that I need to have with the reporter, or maybe the three of us can collectively have. But you seem to have a sense of urgency for this document.
So 5 weeks responding to,
it's not 5 weeks. August 8th is not 5 weeks ago, sir.
Well, 4 weeks. I thought it was a simple question.
You didn't make the request, though.
When the request was made,
Don, he's still addressing you.
When the request was made, did you talk to anyone else about the request?
Certainly. When the request was made formally to me on August 8th, I sent it to all the parties who could provide the answer.
Uh-huh. And did anyone write back to you?
There was some information that came back, but there were also some discussions that needed to take place between our agency and Talbert House. Those discussions I don't control.
So was there information back to you from other staff members saying, hey, hold off on this?
No, absolutely not.
Was this information?
But again, the information was not requested with the sense of urgency that you seem to have for this information, okay. Commissioner Fox.
Was the feedback you got... And again, let me go to the August 8th. You say that was the formal request. Was there a, quote, informal, like over-the-phone request prior to that?
She made the request verbally by phone, and she requested a specific document by title. She asked me to provide her with a copy of that document by title, but stated that she could not send me that when I couldn't find it. She stated she wouldn't send it to me because she couldn't compromise her source, which I imagine might have been you.
Yeah, it was. So the question is, do you recall when she called you with the quote
informal?
No, I don't
recall the date that she called.
Was it before August 8th?
Yes, of course it was before.
Okay, now, then my question, did you get responses when you sent out the request for that information by
But I didn't have the full response in terms of the comments.
But those responses exist.
Mm-hmm.
Can we have copies of all the responses you received?
Certainly.
Everything in writing related to the reporter's request?
Every email that I received related to that answer, certainly.
Every email, every memo, everything that is in electronic format, in hard copy, you know, the standard Freedom of Information request language. Can we have all of that, please?
Yes.
Sure.
Absolutely. Okay. How soon can you give that to the commission?
This afternoon.
This afternoon. All right.
Okay.
One thing... One thing I would, Mr. President, like to make clear, because it was asked of me and even inferred that the board was not aware of problems and there was no action on this contract until after the inquiry from Candace Brooks, that is not accurate. As I told you, we were first aware that there was problems with the program in March. We were aware in the spring of the year that we were trying to figure out what to do, and in June we were keenly aware in June that we were trying to get out of the contract, and that would have been before any request for information.
You now have a revised contract that
yes, we do.
Allows you to avoid the $300,000.
Yes. Yes.
That contract allows you not to have to pay that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Fox, is there anything else? Pastor?
We understood that you wanted our ombudsman report on Marcus Faisal, and we would like to have the privilege to give that to you. Is there any other question about Talbert House or anything else before I bring the ombudsman up? Okay. Our ombudsman is Bill Morrison, and he does an incredible job, and he's going to give the report on Marcus Faisal.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Is that the same thing?
Okay. Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can give.
While he's passing that out, I'd like to state for the record that we did get permission from
the Claremont County prosecutor to release this. I want to make that clear to you that we did get permission to release this.
Okay, Bill. Have you all had a chance to read it?
No.
In advance? I apologize for that.
I looked at it a little bit, but not.
I think it's kind of, it's not my normal practice to give people a document and then start discussing it before they've had a chance to read it. As Reverend Sloan said, my name is Bill Morrison. I'm the ombudsman for Butler County Children's Services. I've been in this role since around last November. I became acting ombudsman, and then I think around March 1st, the board asked me to serve as the permanent ombudsman. I came to Butler County Children's Services in January of 05 as a facilitator of family team meetings. I had retired from Kentucky state government, and as many of us do, began to draw my pension and look for another career. That's one of the advantages of working for the state for 27 years. I just want to say a few words about my background. For the last 10 years with Kentucky state government, I worked for an agency called Protection and Advocacy, which is a federally funded disability rights law office. I think in Ohio it's called Ohio Legal Rights out of Columbus. I was the head mental health advocate there. And in that role, part of my job duties were to conduct death investigations of individuals who had died or were seriously injured in psychiatric or criminal justice facilities around the state. So the turf that I'm in regard to this case is not unfamiliar turf. And the idea of working with an organization as an investigator with an independent point of view that not everybody might like is not in unfamiliar territory for me either. And I want to assure you all that the matters of this report are 100% my words and my belief, okay, and without any influence from any other individual. As I said the other night in our special board meeting, it wouldn't work anyway. I've been that way my whole career, and I don't intend to change. This is a very preliminary report, and I really want to accent on this. It's the first stage in what will probably be a very long investigation. One of the concerns you have anytime that you're doing a death investigation is that there's often going to be associated criminal prosecution that occurs. And it's essential that I, as ombudsman, do not engage in any activity that could, in fact, negatively impair the Claremont County prosecutor in prosecuting the criminals who committed this crime. So my investigation as it exists in Claremont County and in interviewing witnesses will come a little bit down the road when I've received that clearance from the Claremont County prosecutor. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay. Because that would be, if you do that, it can be interpreted as you're interfering with that, and I would never intentionally do that, but I don't want to accidentally do it either. Okay. This report was based to look at one particular issue, which was, did Butler County Children's Services have any information at its disposal, any calls, any written information that could have allowed the agency to predict that something very bad was about to happen to Marcus? As you go through the report, I give a discussion of the fact that we're engaged in a risk assessment business, and that risk assessment is a very difficult business. As Commissioner Fox has pointed out on numerous occasions, it's based on the quality of information you have, and then the analysis of that information, and then the quality of the judgments you make based on the analysis of that information. And it is far but a perfect science. You know, it's far from it. You know, we're trying to predict human behavior. You know, one of the most reliable factors in predicting human behavior is humans' past behavior. You know, and In order to do that, you have to have the kind of information available that could cause you to do that. In this report, you will find that I identify one particular policy violation that occurred. That surrounds an issue when Marcus was removed from his bio mother this last time. He was placed in a foster home that I identify as the W foster home, out of respect for those people who commit their lives as foster parents. That placement did not go very well. They had difficulty managing Marcus's behaviors, and within between 1 and 2 weeks started communicating that they didn't know that this was going to be a placement that would stick for Marcus. According to the policy, which I've included in the report, it says that at that point in time, our ongoing staff should have gone back to our foster care unit and caused them to engage in a review of placement assets, my terminology, placement assets, and then contribute to the discussion of where the next placement would be. That did not go back through the foster care unit, and I think the reason it didn't is it had just been there about 2 weeks before, you know, and they had done such asset review. But I do find no reason to believe that affected the outcome, but it is a violation of policy, and I felt compelled to identify it. I found absolutely no information that would indicate that Butler County had a way, given the current information schemes that we have, to have known this was about to happen. In retrospect, I find that had we known information such as the domestic violence arrest that occurred, such as other adults living in the home, had we known that information, we very may have been able to prevent this tragedy. If there was arrest in any kind of foster home, whether it's ours or a contract foster home, there's a requirement that that be reported to us. We take domestic violence very seriously, whether or not there is a criminal conviction for it. So that would certainly have initiated a review of it. Anytime an adult moves into a foster home that we have children placed in, that adult has to face the same scrutiny as the original adults did, with background checks, character checks. And this is true whether it's in a foster home or it's in a kinship home. And had we known that there were other adults that had moved into that home, that would have at least caused background checks to occur on them, which may or may not have produced information that would have resulted and Marcus being moved to another placement. I don't have any way to know it because I don't have any background information on him. We all have concerns about their backgrounds based on the events that occurred. The state of Ohio, Office of Jobs and Family Services, is at our office right now initiating their investigation of this. And I will work very closely with them and make sure that the agency cooperates in every way, shape, or form. I have confidence in my ability as an agency ombudsman. I take my integrity extremely seriously, but I think we need to recognize that when these kinds of events occur, it's important to have external investigation occur as well as internal investigation. So I welcome that. If I was still an advocate in Kentucky, I would be insisting on it. So I expect that their findings will be similar to mine. I also expect, as we gain more information about this case, that there may be additional problems that are uncovered as we do this, particularly when we get into interviewing witnesses in Claremont County about what was actually going on in that home, something we have very limited information about at this point because it's a matter of the criminal investigation. So please understand that there may be additional findings of fault against the agency. I have no way of knowing that at this point in time, and I don't want to discuss that when it's preliminary and we don't know that information. But I will come back to this body, and I will report anything that either I find or the state finds. I assume they'll report that to you as well, no matter what the consequence of those findings are, just as I've reported the one violation that occurred in the policy by it not going back to the foster care unit. Any questions?
And Mr. Morrison, thank you for your presentation. Would you be in a position to make recommendations that should be implemented before the whole investigation, things that we should do right today?
Absolutely.
And number one, when you mentioned that if we would have known about the domestic charges or the arrest, it says if anyone is arrested, then that should send a red flag to the agency. What I'm suggesting is that all along is that, and into other foster homes, is that any time the police is called to a foster home, the agency needs to be notified. I don't care whether it's for whatever reason, a dog in the, or a cat in a tree or whatever, and they should be notified.
I agree 100%, and it cannot be a system that's based in the concept that they will tell us themselves. You know, that's just the reality of it, and that's where we are right now.
But what I worry about is that, you know, a domestic charge, you know, has taken a long time for someone to make a charge. And if the police, you know, have come out for the domestic disturbances or for whatever reasons, that we should know about it if it's a foster home.
We absolutely should know about it. And in my mind, in Ohio, and this is not something we can solve in Butler County. You know, I mean, if somebody goes to the south side of 275, they're in Hamilton County, and, you know, you can't sit around and predict where did somebody get arrested. You know, you can get arrested in Kentucky, you can get arrested in Butler County, Warren County, Claremont County. You know, the minimal thing we need is a statewide system. I happen to have been involved, and everybody talks about what they know because that's what your background is, the development of Kentucky's statewide criminal history system. As when I was the assistant general manager of pretrial services for Kentucky, they had abolished the commercial bail industry, and I happened to be one of two people that had some experience with the alternative. So as a fledgling social worker, ended up in a position of grave responsibility in developing that program. And we quickly realized, you know, we had staff that were interviewing people at the jail after they were arrested, and then making recommendations to the judge as to who should be released on recognizance and who should be required to post a cash bond, which in Kentucky means a cash bond because there are no bail bonding companies that can post that for you. We quickly realized that we couldn't have those people calling this little city police department, that little city police department, trying to figure out where this person may have a criminal history, because we were going to make way too many mistakes with that. And so we took it on ourselves as part of the Administrative Office of the Courts in Kentucky to develop a comprehensive multi-tiered criminal history system that still exists with advancements today. It today includes things like, you know, and the system starts as soon as a person's arrested, and it continues with booking, it continues with bond, it continues with release on bond, it continues with adjudication, it continues into the penitentiary, it continues through parole, probation, so it follows a case all the way through. So it's also a very functional, efficient system because it automatically sets the court calendar based on who's got arrested the night before, been arrested the night before.
But I also, you know, I think that...
And it also, let me point out one other thing that's key to this. It also has a system built into it based on a tragedy that occurred in Louisville, Kentucky a number of years ago where a gentleman was released from jail and immediately went and murdered his spouse in a department store parking lot, where they put in the phone number of any victim of domestic violence, And if that individual is released from jail, they're automatically notified of that release. And the same technology that tracks those cases in that manner and has done so successfully, I think, for about 10 years in Kentucky now, could be developed in Ohio to ensure that there's an automatic notification that comes into the Children's Services Board of anybody who is a foster parent box checked, you know, on their court records. So, you know, it needs to be something that's done automatically, that's not dependent, even in my mind at least, even on a police officer knowing that this person's a foster parent, because they don't always know that. You know, it needs to be something that's comprehensive, multi-tiered, and ensures that it will occur correctly.
I agree with that, and I would, you know, also hope that you would recommend, like, right away that we go back through our records and cooperate with the police departments, the sheriff's department, to check the foster parents in Butler County, and also our network agencies to check their, to ask the police department, have anyone been called out to this home for whatever reason?
Yeah.
I think that should be done right away.
Absolutely. Those are changes that we will implement. I have been working on a set of recommendations to make in this circumstance. I've been trying to, we've heard a lot of good things from the public. You know, I mean, the sad truth is that every tragedy has a positive element to it because it does focus attention on the problems that exist with our systems, and it creates an atmosphere, thanks to our media friends, that gets the public attention focused in a way that you can have the will and the political will to do something to solve this problem. You know, we need to have an intermediate plan because what I'm talking about is not going to happen overnight. You know, we need to completely review that. That is one of the recommendations I have in the hopper. I chose to deal with this case and this particular issue in the preliminary report. There'll be a number of recommendations that you all will be privy to that I will be making as we go through and fully analyze what happened here. A lot of it's information. Information's the key to risk assessment. If you don't have the right information, you cannot make the correct decision. And don't take that to mean that I'm saying we made an incorrect decision. I'm saying we didn't have all the information.
Mr. Morrison, would you be willing to serve on the commission's review?
I would be very proud to.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your support, and thanks for the assistance in allowing me to be able to release this report. I'm, like Mike, I've been a crusader toward public openness my whole career, and I fully believe that we should be as open as we can possibly be, and it was bugging me to death to have a report that I couldn't release to the press.
Chuck, so.
No, I just covered everything.
Mike?
I do have a couple of questions, and I know this preliminary report. Talk about the type of child Marcus was for a moment. Sometimes, and maybe often, you're more familiar with this because of your background in mental health, an autistic child, the placement around other children is a factor in a placement decision. In other words, some autistic children kind of withdraw and don't want to be placed in. In other words, they're better off, the fewer children they're around, the more likely they're going to be to come out of their shell. Was there any discussion in the that you can talk about in Marcus's background in the placement factors that were considered in his placement? That, particularly given the problems that they had in the first placement, which I understand there were other children involved, that placing Marcus in a home with other children would be problematic.
Well, I think what the agency did, and I think this is part of what's going to continue to be analyzed as the state looks at this whole set of issues and how we match kids with foster homes. What the agency did, and this is something back in the 80s, I managed Kentucky's foster care review board system, which was an auditing function over the state of Kentucky's foster care system. And at that time, a lot of the findings that I had was that the state didn't tell foster parents the truth about the behaviors the kids had because they were trying to find somebody that would take the kid, you know. And I ran into this over and over because I was part of the Foster Parent Association in that role and worked with them really closely. And I was a strong advocate that you had to tell people the truth so they knew what they get with, even if it made it more difficult to place. I'm proud to say in this event, we told Lifeway every behavior that this child had and received very concrete assurances and plans as to how they were going to deal with each of those behaviors. The reality is that had, and this is based on what I know at this moment in time, okay, had the Carrolls had no other children in the home, I believe Marcus would probably be murdered anyway, you know, because that was a psychological problem that they had that I believe probably caused this crime to occur, this alleged crime to have occurred. So is that an issue that might have saved Marcus? No, I don't think so. In my opinion, it's not. It's an issue that we need to look and make sure we know who we're dealing with and who we're placing children with. Certainly, there may be some advantages to a smaller number of kids around autism. And I'm not really sure that this child was autistic. There's some debate as to whether it was autism or fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm not sure of which one. And they have a lot of similar characteristics anyway.
Was there a medical assessment done on Marcus?
Generally, you do not diagnose a child that young with this thing. They're called pervasive developmental disorders. And when they get up to about seven, something like this, you start getting a little bit more specific diagnoses. You know, so I think he was believed to be autistic or to have fetal alcohol syndrome. Autism is a sensory integration disorder. And so when you look at a child's needs that has autism, assuming that Marcus did, which I don't know, one of the most effective behavior management strategies is to lower the sensory input in the environment in which the child exists. So if I was placing a child with autism, which I did many times in a school district, you know, the typical kindergarten, first grade schoolroom with all the colors on the walls and the fluorescent lights in the ceiling is not a good environment. It may look good to us adults and we think, isn't this cheery? But it creates a stimulation problem for the child. I haven't had a chance to see what the home was like. I know that he did have, my understanding is he had his own room, which would be a good idea, and that we received very specific assurances from Lifeway that they had considered all the behaviors that we had advised them of, and that they had a plan in place that would ensure that he was receiving 24/7 supervision. You know, he was to begin a TIP program, which would have taken him out of the house for most of the day, which is an education program. You know, if you look at it from the standpoint of, like, services to Marcus, the agency provided Marcus with a maximum level of services within that foster home. Did that be enough? As I've heard Pastor Sloan, obviously not, you know, but it's important that we realize that what really happened here, you know, and as we grow through this experience and learn more and, you know, as I've promised, I'll get back with you, be glad to serve on the committee. But what really happened here is two people who have some kind of an issue that none of us understand because we can't, committed a horrible crime, you know.
But, Mr. President, if a child that presented with the types of problems that Marcus presented, whether it was fetal alcohol syndrome or autism or something else, were being placed by our agency in a home that we, I got to get the terminology right, that we directly contract with rather than a network place, mm-hmm. would the standards that would have been the expectations of the skill or training level, was there any specific training that would be expected, for example, of a foster placement to deal with a child who was autistic or whatever? Would we have standards that were different from the standards that were acceptable to Lifeway, if you know.
Yeah. The discipline that predominantly deals with this issue with kids with these pervasive developmental disorders is occupational therapy. In Kentucky, that's whom I relied on for recommendations about how to set up classrooms, how to communicate, right, how to facilitate structure. And we had made arrangements for a referral to be made to an occupational therapist in those services. I can't recall exactly if they had begun or they were about to begin, but those arrangements had been made through Claremont County MRDD.
Well, I notice in your report you say the willingness to accept Marcus in their home. The special needs kid, whatever that special need is.
Yeah.
In the foster, because you recounted stories in Kentucky where there were times when, you know, they just needed a place, and we'll get to the quality of that place later. We just need a place for this child who needs help. Do we have what I'm getting to, there's two parts of this Marcus track, and the first is, was there anything that could have been done within the system that would have resulted in a, you know, Marcus still being with us today? So you look at those questions. Mm-hmm. The second question, as we go forward, which is, to me, at this point, frankly, more important.
Obviously.
We can't bring Marcus back, is what modifications to our system can we make to lower risk? Because it's risk management.
Mm-hmm.
And you've already made one, or somebody, the agency's already said they're going to do some things. For example, they're no longer delegate responsibility for independent or for monitoring, mm-hmm, for the network. Mm-hmm. The agency will directly do those monthly visits to the home and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The information issue, we're going to look at that, whether it's a state, we need a statewide solution as they do in Kentucky, or whether or not we can, in the meantime, as Commissioner John Lovetta suggested, maybe we can work out some arrangements. We know where the foster kids are placed. Maybe we can work out some arrangements with those local police authorities to track certain addresses and so forth. Mm-hmm. Don't know. But there are going to be some recommendations in terms of what system changes and modifications can be made, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So with respect to the placement of a special needs child now, in terms of how it worked when Marcus was placed, other than a willingness to accept the child in their home, were there any training requirements prior to placement expected of somebody dealing with an autistic child, which are very, very difficult children to deal with?
Well, I have not pulled the files from Lifeway at this point in time.
I mean, if it were our agency.
There is behavior management training, and my understanding is the Carrolls had participated in behavior management training. Child behavior management training.
Or specifically to these special needs
children. I'm not aware that they had participated in behavior management training for children with these types of disabilities.
With an autistic child, I mean, virtually every intervention or transaction with that child has a therapeutic effect. Fair enough?
Yeah. It's either good or it's bad.
It's either good or bad. Because these are children that just, we don't begin to understand what's going on, except that we know that you can, just the simplest of transactions with that child can create a whole list of problems.
Well, and it's, you know, and this is one of the great difficulties, and this area I've worked in a great deal, you know, and it may be more than just about anybody else that's at Butler County Children's Services, but I probably represented, I don't know, 40 kids in 10 years that had autism in Kentucky, and predominantly I was looking at rights issues involving the local school districts and what services they were providing the child and family. And even the two twins that I represented were nothing like each other. You know, I mean, it's not really a thing where you can say, here is the plan for a child that has autism. You know, it's something that you have to engage other fields of discipline, As I pointed out, occupational therapy is a primary field in this arena. And each child's needs, you know, have to be considered completely individually.
If I'm going to be a foster parent of an autistic child, in an ideal system, should I be expected to have specialized training in dealing with an autistic child?
In an ideal system, what you would do, I mean, I haven't seen any specialized training that is individualized enough.
You get an overview. Generally for autistic children.
I think having training on how to deal with autistic kids would be good. What would be better is to employ the professions that deal with this, like occupational therapy, to come into that person's home, just as we do now with parental training, and work with that child and that foster parent and develop systems within that home that will reduce the frustration level on the areas of sensory integration that that particular child has.
And that was in motion.
That was in motion, but...
So you're saying that there's no need to have particular specialized training for an autistic child. We just kind of give you the support services once the placement's made.
I think that specialized, I'm not saying it's a bad idea to have specialized training, but it's so different with every kid as to what their triggers are, that most specialized training is not nearly as effective as individualized training. In particular, since it is environmental, for instance, if I came into this room, you might see things. The fact that those are not fluorescent lights, are they? Fluorescent lights are a big key for kids with autism. And so you're thinking about all that, and you evaluate it, and then you put those evaluations, what you've learned, in place in that home, and you work with that parent, and they say, he did this last night. And the occupational therapist, maybe working with somebody that's a psychologist as well, say, well, when he does this, try this approach to it. Here's your steps. He never gets out of bed when he's supposed to get out of bed. Here's some different types of alarm systems that might help. What you're trying to do is allow the child to perform with as much autonomy as possible. We want to create independence in children, because that's a critical factor in what'll happen to them for the rest of their lives.
Let me shift to the information side real quick.
Let's begin to wrap this up.
I will. Said found no information received by CCSB that would indicate there were problems in developing in Marcus's placement. You couldn't find anything that threw up a red flag or anything. Now, we received an email from somebody that basically did a Google search on this family's name. And I guess you guys even, did you actually do it, whatever? Yeah.
Somebody sent it to me, through our public.
And they said that, just type in the Carroll's name, and they had lived in, a bunch of homes. And now there's a lot of stuff that.
That's obviously one of the stopgap measures we need to employ immediately.
The clerk of court's webpage or something that could find about the domestic violence charge.
Yeah, they claimed in like about 15 minutes they had quite a bit of information on the Carrolls. They claim, and I don't know the timeline on this when it went on, but they claim that it was available to anybody that would have gone just on the old-fashioned or new-fashioned Googles, if you will. So presently, there was no backup system inside the agency that would, they say, oh, they're placing this child with the Carrolls. I don't have this real fancy integrated system I'd like to have through child welfare, but let me just Google that name and do a check of the local court records.
I think it's a wise idea. It makes sense to me. I did not do a Google search on the Carrolls as part of my investigation. And the reason for that is I was looking at the information we had and when we had it and how do we react to it.
So back to something of value that you and I commonly share, and that's something I just beat the drum on, which gets confused with I'm beating on the agency. I'm not. I'm beating on, is there information available? Are there ways to get it? Are we being entrepreneurial, innovative?
Absolutely.
and that's my thing.
Yeah.
Because I believe if good people have the right information, more often than not, they'll make good decisions.
Yeah.
So the issue here was the system. And as you pointed out, right from the beginning, this child, I'd like to know more, for example, about the fetal alcohol syndrome issue. I mean, if there's any way of knowing that, because, you know, when I was in the legislature, I put in a bill that said if a mother delivers a fetal alcohol child or a drug child, a child with drug, and I want to send her to prison.
Yeah.
If you're an adult and you give a child drugs or alcohol, you give that to a toddler in their milk, you're going to go to prison. That's a felony. But if you're carrying that child and you ingest drugs, you ingest alcohol, and that child comes into this world with those types of problems, you go to the neonatal unit over children's and you see these poor little children that are marijuana babies and others, that mother bears responsibility. If this is fetal alcohol that drove these problems, that mother is every bit as equally responsible for the death of this child as the people that put him in that closet because she knew better than to
please
drink.
Let me be perfectly clear. I'm not diagnosing that he had fetal alcohol syndrome. You know, I'm saying that there was a mention of that possibility in the record, that I didn't see an affirmative diagnosis of autism. You know, just based on what I've reviewed, it really could be one or it could be the other. We don't know what causes autism either. So that's a very complicated issue that there's a whole lot of opinion on. But the bottom line is, you know, we need to develop and utilize every resource for information that we can possibly find, you know, and find the most efficient ways to do that and the most agile ways in order to turn that information into something that can be analyzed, and then through good desertion determine what actions should be taken based on the information and the analysis.
I have three quick questions. One, where's the father? Where's the father? Does anybody know where the father is?
No.
Does anybody know who the father is? Secondly, in terms of the initial removal process and placement options, you do that. There's a word for it. I don't know. They do the mapping of, you know, grandmas, aunts, uncles, and so forth. Have you had an opportunity to review that yet in terms of what I think that's what your committee does, but what you call placement assets. Did they go through that process and say, gee, there's no grandma here or that suitable to take this child and all that?
Yeah.
And third,
it was not a family that had a lot of resources.
Okay.
And let me say this, just in case I want to be clear about this. In the report I gave you today, okay, and I don't know what you had before because I didn't give it to you, but I think it's the same. The one thing I did remove from that report was a little bit of discussion about the interaction between the agency and the biological mother. And the reason I took that out is, given the fact that there is a lawsuit pending, I didn't want to appear to be retaliating against her in any way, shape, or form. So I described that a little bit more generically than I originally described it. And that was my decision to do it that way, that I thought it might look like retaliation or piling on, and I didn't want to be part of that.
And my last question relating to information. One, I'd still like to see all the records related to this case released, and if the director, chairman, board, whoever is the designee, can have a conversation with the prosecutor in Claremont County, just open up all the files. Let the good, bad, and the ugly, because in this case, from what everything I've heard, that when the files are opened, the public is going to understand that the agency, based on what they had,
I think that should be run by our prosecutor as well in light of the recent lawsuits. So.
Yeah, run it by him, but, I mean, they're going to eventually get it in discovery anyway, but that's a lawyer thing.
I will
it's amazing, if the child were alive, we've got a lot more discretion in releasing records than if a child is been killed. So, but anyway, that's something personally, that's just a thing with me. I think that particularly in all these things, they should be released. The only exception is the issue of does it impair the prosecution. Mm-hmm. If there's something in there that would impair the prosecution of these folks, then that can be restrained. As far as our exposure as a county, if we had culpability, if there's some legal culpability in there, the public has a right to know. And I don't want to play games with lawyer games about, gee, well, let's don't release that document because that might help the people suing us. That person suing us, in my opinion, has absolutely, the whole thought is disgusting to me. But nonetheless, the county has to be accountable, just like I've been asking this agency to be accountable. We're on that lawsuit, and let it all out. And whatever it takes to get every document related to this case into the public record, I'd like the board and the agency to do everything possible, and I appreciate you taking the step to get permission to release what you could. And finally, as we go into this review, I'd like to have, and you can pick a reasonable period, 3 years or whatever, one of the things that you do in your capacity as ombudsman, one of the things that happens in the board minutes and so forth is ideas about, gee, we ought to be doing this, we ought to be doing that. Inside of ombudsman reports and agency, what do you call them, minutes of the meetings, are ideas that have been discussed. There's no point reinventing the wheel. If you've already looked at issues that are on the record, it would be beneficial to us as we start the review process to have the benefit of what issues have already been identified. Can you please get to us a copy of every ombudsman report that has been issued on any policy? I'm not talking about tell me about case names and identifiers. I'm talking about, you know, I'm recommending because of the policy issues here, here are the things that we find, here are the recommendations we make, here are that stuff, and also board minutes. You can go back like 3 years or whatever number you want, at least three if you want to go further, but just get to us so as we start our study, we can just kind of go through and say, well, what issues have already been identified and brought and discussed at the board and by the ombudsman that we need to take another look at.
Yeah. And I know for sure what I've done. You know, I'm a little less sure. I wasn't asked to be ombudsman until the last ombudsman had already left, so I kind of picked it up at where it was.
But
so,
those reports,
but I can,
are in
those
the file
reports
complaint.
Exist. In fact, we have an open records request right now that I received, I think, yesterday, and my assistant's in the process right now of accumulating that for release. So okay. That's no problem at all.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation and your willingness to serve on the board, and we look forward to your service.
I appreciate it very much.
Well,
thank you.
One last thing. Can you get me that comparison I was looking for on this spreadsheet? I'd just like it laid out. Here they are. The utilization by month. Here's the one I originally gave. Here's the one that we got today. And all I want to know is what are the accurate figures on utilization, cost per month, and then you can sort it out.
The days, bed days.
Bed days per month. In other words, you had 8 bed days utilized in the month of January, and this report says you owed that much. Your agency report says you. In other words,
I'll find what I can and I'll get it to you, and you can tell me if it's what you want.
You know what I want is a spreadsheet that just goes.
This is not one of my skill areas, but I will do what I can.
I think the pastor can do that with the finance.
I will assure the commission that I will get this to you in a very timely fashion, very detailed. And I would also like to go on public record that Mike or Commissioner Fox, I could not agree with you more. I have looked at a lot of records, and trust me, I would love to see everything about Marcus Faisal made public because it would be to our advantage. We are having to honor the very, very important principle of making sure we don't impede or in any way jeopardize Claremont County prosecutor. We don't want these Carrolls to have any chance of an appeal from some sharp defense lawyer because we made a mistake in something we did. But we will do all we can to get as much as we can. And I would like to say to Candace or any other media, if you do not get information you ask for
from our agency in a timely manner, contact me personally, because we are not going to tolerate, if there has been any stonewalling, we're not going to tolerate it. We account to you, and if you'll give us the chance, we will do this thing right. Thank you.
Pastor, one other issue that you mentioned to me before the meeting that you weren't at liberty to talk about. I know that the young lady's here to talk to the commission. She raised her hand before about wanting to talk. Are you willing to make any comments on that, or Mrs. Street?
Our ombudsman is doing an in-depth investigation. We would like to be able to communicate with the commissioners, and we need to be legally advised by Robin Piper. We need advice from everybody, from Doug Duckett to whoever. We do not want to jeopardize the county in any way, but we want to deal with this thing right.
Okay.
We are looking into this matter, and we want to deal with this thing right.
Okay. And you would say a week?
Okay, Jan, what would you say? Come on, Jan.
If she would agree to sign a release of information, then we will be able to share it.
We understand that today she is doing that. We need to have those releases in our hands. Okay. Then we can release information.
She meaning Joetta?
All parties.
All parties.
I understand.
We have two parties involved. We have the release forms with us. We brought them to her today, meaning Mrs. Street.
Right.
And we have legal obligations, two directions here.
Well, got it. Let's just make sure that we get the information.
Yeah, we are on top of this one.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. We have communications.
First would be approved minutes from the last meeting, approved travel and training, receive and refer bids for truck barn, traffic specialist, execute contract for traffic specialist and Aeromark Incorporated under Environmental Services, award contract for Miami Western Contractors, execute agreements with Brown and Caldwell, Ohio, and agreement number one with Short Engineering, release maintenance bonds for Knowles of Liberty Estates, lots 1-9. Execute contract 6-A5 with Miami Western Contractors. Under finance, approve transfers and appropriations and transfer and appropriations for county care facility. Execute contract community counseling and crisis center. Execute agreement with Hamilton Living Water Ministry. Number 15 is pulled until next meeting. Approve reimbursement to Cartwell for EMA. And then I have one last one, is to approve a resolution asking Liberty Township to remove their moratorium on B2 zoning to allow Procter & Gamble construction of the first in the kind of United States, a prototype store in Liberty Township.
Move to approve.
Second.
Commissioner Fox?
Yes.
Commissioner Furman?
Yes.
And Commissioner Jolivet?
Yes.
Thank you.
Is there anything else the commission would like to
bring up? Executive session, if we can. Either we could go now and do it for a few minutes, or
we'll do it.
Come back. We could do it now for a few minutes, okay. If everyone takes a few minutes.
Whatever you guys.
All right, let's do 12 o'clock, we'll just say, for executive session. Need a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Commissioner Fox?
Yes.
Commissioner Furman?
Yes.
Commissioner Jolivet?
Yes. Okay. For motion to go into executive session?
Oh, all you got to do session. Is, yeah, we're reconvening. Okay. Adjourned.
Whatever they call it.
Recess.
All right.
Hey, Michael.